Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a new crop of exoplanets from NASA's Kepler mission. But first, as Attorney General Jeff Sessions said recently, the U.S. is, quote, in the midst of an historic drug epidemic. Opioid and heroin addiction kill 91 people in the U.S. every day. But in his letter to Congress, Sessions was requesting permission to prosecute medical marijuana providers. Why is that? What's the connection? Perhaps he's under the impression that marijuana use leads people into harder stuff, the old gateway drug principle. But studies suggest that in states where medical marijuana has been made legal, there is actually less opioid use. So going after providers in those states could make an already terrible and historic drug epidemic a lot worse. Here to discuss this with me is Dina Fine-Marin, editor for Medicine and Health at Scientific American, David Bradford, professor of public health at the University of Georgia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Thank you.
Hi there. Dina, what Sessions wrote was pretty cryptic because he seemed to refer to our historic drug epidemic, and then he went on to talk about cracking down on marijuana. What's going on here?
Right. Yeah, it is a very misleading characterization of the current drug epidemic in our country, which, as you mentioned in the opening, is really an opioid epidemic, which means heroin, prescription drug abuse, fentanyl, not at all about marijuana or medical marijuana. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions has long said that medical marijuana is overhyped and is contributing to this quote-unquote epidemic.
Is there any evidence to suggest that marijuana is contributing to the epidemic, like a gateway drug?
In short, no. The National Institute on Drug Abuse has looked at the science of that idea of a gateway drug, and they do say that marijuana may prime the brain, as alcohol might, to have an enhanced response to drugs. But the majority of people who use weed do not go on to use other harder substances. And the reality here is that all the literature suggests that marijuana is not as addictive or as lethal as opioids. Indeed, as you mentioned, states with medical marijuana programs have significantly fewer deaths from prescription painkiller opioids. And the reality is that the literature right now suggests that if anyone is using an opioid, whether it be a prescription painkiller or something like heroin, a prescription painkiller is more likely to lead to a drug abuse because it's more addictive and obviously it can be more lethal. So really, if we stopped medical marijuana programs that are now in place in 29 states and Washington, D.C. right now, the science suggests we would worsen the opioid epidemic. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, nearly half of young people who inject heroin first abused prescription opioids.
David, your studies that helped shed some light on whether or not legalized marijuana is making the opioid epidemic better in states, were you surprised by your results?
You know, I would say we really weren't. My co-author, Ashley Bradford, who's also my daughter, as it turns out, and I have two studies in the journal Health Affairs, which is a leading peer-reviewed health policy journal in the world. And in the first one, we took a look at the impact of medical marijuana laws on prescription use in Medicare. And what we found there was significant reductions in prescription use, most notably among pain medications. The largest plurality of those would be opiates. We redid the study for Medicaid just this past month in Health Affairs and again found large reductions in the use of prescription pain medications when states turned on medical cannabis laws. And I would say we've done some additional work with colleagues here at the University of Georgia, Amanda Abraham and Grace Adams, looking at deaths at the county level. And when states turn on dispensary-based medical cannabis laws, we see significant reductions in opiate-related deaths. In fact, we estimate that in 2014, if all states had turned those on, we would have saved almost 2,000 lives that year.
So are you saying that if you make medical marijuana legal, you could turn the tide on opiate deaths?
Well, you know, the estimates that we have with the paper that we just presented at an international health policy conference a couple of months ago would suggest that we are looking at reductions that are in the 2-3% range. So there is no one silver bullet to the opiate crisis. This is a crisis with many roots to it. But unfortunately, with the introduction of fentanyl into the black market here in the United States, mm-hmm. it seems that the crisis is accelerating again. So we absolutely need to use every tool in our arsenal. And as Dina has just said, cannabis is a safe drug relative to the opiates. The ratio of the fatal dose to the effective dose for a drug like heroin, for example, is five times the typical dose of heroin will kill you. There has never been a documented case of death from cannabis use, and so relative to opiates, relative to alcohol, where that ratio is 10, cannabis is definitely safer. And to the extent that the National Institutes of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine just this past January issued a comprehensive report where they said there is conclusive evidence that the cannabis can be effective at managing pain. So to the extent we can divert people from initially starting on opiates through legitimate prescriptions, we divert them from the path of abuse and then the path of death. And it does seem that cannabis could be one tool in the arsenal to do that.
Mm. Dina, if this amendment that Sessions is talking about, one that sort of directs the federal government not to go after medical use of marijuana in the states, if that does not get renewed, what could happen?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is that Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, which is named after the legislators that initially suggested this bill, and it keeps the Department of Justice from using taxpayer money to interfere with state medical marijuana programs. So it expires at the end of the fiscal year right now, which is the end of September. And if it's not renewed, that means that Jeff Sessions and his office could go ahead and prosecute dispensaries. And in that situation, it would really probably have a chilling effect on both the growth of the medical marijuana industry, which has been growing in recent years, and also have an intimidating effect on patients, both making it more difficult for them to get this substance that many of them mm-hmm. consider a lifeline, and also making them feel like maybe they're doing something wrong by trying to seek it in the first place. So it would have a really big problem.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sign that this would be a popular move for him to do?
Really, there's not. Obviously, the states have spoken by legalizing medical marijuana in the majority of U.S. states right now. And there's a significant amount of literature showing that people want medical marijuana to be available, both scientific literature that's looked at the before and after when state laws have come into effect, and also just anecdotal polls that have taken place where people say, yeah, they're in favor of medical marijuana. One of the interesting things as well is that the U.S. Department of Justice, which obviously Jeff Sessions heads up, puts out an annual report, the Drug Enforcement Administration, which is under the Department of Justice. They put out an annual report on drug threat assessments to the country. And the latest report available enumerated the top threats to the country from drugs, and medical marijuana wasn't one of them.
Hmm. David, in your study, you touched on this a little bit. I want to revisit it just for a second. Was there any difference between states that have legalized recreational cannabis versus just medical marijuana?
That's a great question. And one of the unfortunate things is that, from a researcher standpoint, is that the experience of states with recreational cannabis is very new relative to the data we have. There's an unfortunate lag in when large quantitative data sets are available and when the world actually happened that they were measuring. And so, recreational cannabis came online in Colorado at the end of 2014, and we just don't have the data to study that. I will say that preliminary evidence coming out of Colorado and out of the state of Washington, out of the state of Oregon, suggests that, in fact, the recreational cannabis has not led to the sorts of problems that opponents might have suspected. Indeed, there is some evidence that things like traffic fatalities have actually gone down as a consequence.
And the fact we have talked about this before on the program, and the fact that marijuana is classified as a Schedule 1 drug, Dina, doesn't that make it even more difficult for researchers to come up with new data?
Exactly. Yeah, that federal status, which again is put in place by the U.S. Department of Justice's Department of Drug Enforcement Administration, means that researchers have difficulty obtaining marijuana to conduct the comprehensive studies that would be necessary to clarify the potential benefits of medical marijuana. And that obviously is taking place even as many states have defied that federal prohibition, and the cannabis industry certainly is booming.
Mm-hmm. So is this so are we talking more when we talk about Attorney General Sessions? Are we talking more about politics versus evidence here, Dina?
It certainly seems that way. Obviously, I don't know what's going on in Jeff Sessions' head, but this does seem to be strongly a political move, since it's not in alignment with science or what the annual report from his own agency suggests.
It would seem that with the growing popularity of medical marijuana and states, more and more states getting into legalizing it, and other states going with recreational marijuana, this is a tide that's not going to be turned back.
Exactly. Yeah, it would be interesting and obviously terrible for patients, but if the amendment is not renewed, that I would think would lead to a court case that would play out through the system. If a dispensary is prosecuted and then that moves into a larger level, that would sort of be a test balloon to see where states and where dispensaries stand as opposed to the Department of Justice's stance.
And seeing how much money is being made in the industry, marijuana industry and other, companies getting into it, you have meetings of marijuana makers and producers and suppliers. You have all kinds of people getting together to, get ready for this new industry. I would imagine there's a lot of pushback coming from there also.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A recent study found that chronic pain sufferers who used cannabis reported a 64% drop in opioid use, as well as fewer negative side effects and a better quality of life than they experienced under opioids. So there's definitely a tide from the medical patient community of folks that really seem to be happy with the cannabis opportunity.
We did reach out to Attorney General Sessions' office to reply, and we did not get any response for them. But I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Dina Fine-Marin, Editor for Medicine and Health at Scientific American. David Bradford, Professor of Public Health, University of Georgia. Thanks again for taking time to be with us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, getting to know the placenta. Yes, I said the placenta. Didn't you get up this morning and say, hey, I'd love to talk about the placenta? Well, it is a really interesting organ that really gets little attention. And if you're a parent, you have paid attention to it before. But we'll talk about what we need to know and what we don't know yet about how the placenta works. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking now about the placenta, as I said before. And unless you're a parent, you may not know all the ways the placenta is important to the development of a healthy baby. It provides nutrition and circulation, and it removes wastes. But even doctors don't have a very detailed picture of how the placenta is managing all of this during a pregnancy. What we do know comes from studies of the placenta after the baby is born or in animal models. To measure the function of the human placenta in real time, well, you can imagine it's a much more difficult task, one that a group of Boston-based researchers recently undertook. In a landmark study of identical twins in the womb, Dr. Ellen Grant and a team of colleagues discovered that a shared placenta may deliver oxygen more slowly to one twin than the other. Why would the placenta prefer one twin over the other? Well, let's try to find out. Dr. Ellen Grant is professor of radiology and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Science Friday. Dr. Grant, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Let me.
Great.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
No problem.
Let's talk about your study. Describe what you did to get the results about the oxygen delivery.
We recruited mothers that had twin pregnancies, so identical twins, and we asked the mothers to lie in an MRI scanner, and for part of the time, we asked them to breathe 100% oxygen, and we tracked that oxygen from what they were breathing down through the maternal blood into the placenta and tracked it across the placenta into the different fetuses.
And so you found that one fetus got more oxygen than the other?
Yeah, what we did is we wanted to understand how the placental function might be altering fetal development. So we chose twin fetuses that were very different in size, although identical genetically. And this way we knew their genetic growth potential was identical, the maternal environment was identical, and their gestational age was identical. So we could look at the placental function by tracking how fast the oxygen traveled across the placenta to the fetus. So we found that in the smaller fetuses, the time that it took the oxygen to reach its maximum value was longer in the smaller twins, and the twins that ended up being smaller at birth.
So they were smaller because of the less oxygen they received?
That's what we presume, is that the placenta was not functioning as effectively on the side with the smaller twins, and we think that is related to the slower growth in those twins and probably related to, and further studies, we're going to explore this more, we think it alters how genes are expressed when you have a different placental in utero environment.
Do you have any idea why one fetus was preferred over the other, received more oxygen?
It's not clear, and we don't understand why there is this discordance some pregnancies. And up to now, no one's really been able to monitor the different placenta to see if this might be related to placental function. But that was one of the exciting things about this study. We could show that the twins that were smaller were related to the smaller to the placenta with the poor function. So now we can start to think about what are some treatments that might be useful and have a method of monitoring whether treatments are going to be effective.
Mm-hmm. Your study is part of the Human Placenta Project at NIH, which funds research aimed at understanding the role of the placenta in health and disease. So I'd like to bring on the director. Diana Bianchi is director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you, because we never get a chance to talk about the placenta. Many people don't.
Many people don't talk about it, but everybody was connected to one at some point in their lives. So it's very important. When you look at your belly button, that's one end of the placenta, and the other end was connected via the umbilical cord to the actual organ itself.
Now, is the placenta actually considered part of the fetus?
So it's interesting because it has components of both the fetus and the mother. So it is, the majority of it is fetal tissue genetically, but there's a backside to it that interconnects directly with the mother's womb, and that part contains tissue from the mother. But they're very closely connected. In fact, to some extent, the placenta invades the mother's uterine wall, and that's normal. That should happen.
Are there cases where there's something abnormal goes on when, it does it the wrong way, invading the wall?
Yes. Actually, if the placenta doesn't form normally and the blood vessels connecting to the mother's blood system don't form normally, that can result in a condition called preeclampsia, which is truly a life-threatening condition for the mother and results in complications for the baby. And it affects approximately 7% of pregnant women.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this study with Dr. Grant. Do we know anything about how the placenta carries oxygen before this study?
Well, we have some indirect measures. So we can measure blood flow by various ultrasound techniques. But the beauty of Dr. Grant's work is that by giving these mothers extra oxygen, she could track how that oxygen was flowing across the two placentas and really show that the longer it took for the oxygen to flow across the fetal placentas, that correlated with abnormalities in the particular fetus that had a slower transition of the oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Think about our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to talk about this. And you can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. What was the impetus to do this study? Was there something in particular you wanted to study, Dr. Grant?
Yeah, we really wanted to get at measures that could monitor placental function regionally and throughout the pregnancy. So we wanted to be able to not just look at the placenta after it's born, but be able to monitor its function during the pregnancy when it's actually alive and functioning. And one of the main nutrients that the placenta provides to the fetuses is oxygen. And knowing that we can see oxygen on MRI, we set out to track and quantify how oxygen regionally is passed through the placenta to the fetal blood.
Is this something, a technique then, that would be a screening technique for all pregnancies or with twins?
We're hoping to actually extend it to singletons as well, too. We need a bit more work in terms of creating the equivalent of a growth curve for the placenta across gestation and get a bit better understanding of the differences that can happen due to, say, changes in maternal position, changes in maternal size. So we have a bit of work to do, but that's the goal, is to have a study that will provide more quantitative numbers of placental function during pregnancy to help identify those mothers whose placentas are not functioning normally.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bianchi, do results like this make you think, you know, there's a lot we still don't know about?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of the reason why NICHD, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, has dedicated, at the present time, over $54 million in research funding. And currently, we're funding about 29 projects, about half of which have to do with imaging, all of which are supporting our goal to non-invasively study the placenta in real time while the woman is still pregnant. We have a lot of information about the placenta after delivery, but that's kind of like studying the heart after it's stopped beating. And so it doesn't really help us predict what are the complications that are going to occur, and it doesn't help us determine which baby needs to be delivered right now. Because babies can be small for a variety of reasons. You could be genetically predisposed to be small, mm-hmm. and that baby should basically stay in the womb. But if a baby is suffering due to lack of oxygen or nutrients, it may be better for both the baby and the mother to be delivered early.
Right.
But you're constantly trying to weigh the risks of an unexpected premature delivery for medical indications versus the risks of staying in the womb when it's not a good idea.
We're going to go to the phones, 844-724-8255, if you have questions about placenta and fetal development. And please keep your suggestions for placenta recipes to yourself. Couldn't believe it. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jesse in Rochester. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. So it sounds like you've discovered that the placenta among identical twins would favor one over the other. My twin identical sons had twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, which sounds like kind of an hyperactive tendency of the placenta to want to feed one and deplete the other. I wonder if you could speak to how your new findings might be related to the twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome.
Okay. Yeah, could you explain a little more what that is?
Yeah, twin-twin transfusion syndrome is when the vessels in the placenta from one twin and the other have abnormal connections. So one twin steals blood from the other twin directly. In our particular study, we excluded twins with those abnormalities, but we're hoping that moving forward, we can also look at how that transport of nutrients is altered with abnormal connections. And probably like anything, the placenta, you know, is a spectrum. In one spectrum, there's a stealing of blood from one twin to the other, and in another end of the spectrum, there's one placenta that isn't functioning as well as it should be. So there's trying to understand where the boundaries are between normal and abnormal are some of the things we hope to do better as we move forward and can better understand placental function. And just to clarify, in our study, we specifically chose on purpose twins that were different in size. The vast majority of our identical twins are very similar in size, and you don't see this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that you used something called Bold MRI for this most recent study. How does that work?
Bold MRI is blood oxygen level dependent. That's what BOLD stands for. Mm. It means that the signal intensity on an MR image is dependent on the oxygen concentration. It's actually the sequence that's used for functional imaging as well, too, except for the oxygen changes are due to neuronal demand. Here, we gave the mothers oxygen, exposed them to oxygen, and tracked that oxygen through the blood using an image that changes in brightness when the oxygen reaches the vessels.
Let's go to the phones to Boulder, Colorado, with Erin. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Hi, I have a question. I had two placentas. I was pregnant with my second child. I had two placentas, and there was only one baby, and the doctors couldn't explain why. When the baby was actually born, they discovered they by C-section because the other placenta was covering my cervix. Excuse me. So I had to have a C-section. They discovered that I had a velamentous umbilical cord, which means it wasn't fully attached. So I was wondering if you had any ideas why there were two placentas, because they didn't have any idea, or if they did have an idea, they didn't want to tell me, but.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's possible there's the. Oh, go ahead, Diana.
No, I was going to say, so my background is I'm a geneticist and a neonatologist, and I was going to say that one possibility is that there was actually a twin pregnancy, but not necessarily identical twins. So one of the twins could have had a specific reason, like a genetic abnormality, for dying in the womb. But when there's another placenta there, it can actually keep the second placenta alive, even though long ago, probably early in the pregnancy, the second fetus might have died naturally.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255, or you're listening to Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking about everything placenta, and suddenly the boards have lit up. A lot of people interested in the placenta. Let's see if we have we have some tweets coming in. Let's can you ask your guests about Johan wants to know about single umbilical artery. Usually there are two. What's the biology of having just one? Anybody know that one?
Well, it is what we call a minor malformation. It's not infrequent. You have to have at least one. But I'm aware of people having anywhere between one and four, even though two is the more common number. But that in and of itself shouldn't have any long-term consequences unless it was associated with other malformations.
Here's a question. Should we recommend now that pregnant women take a little extra oxygen if they're carrying twins?
I think we don't really understand the answer to that yet. There are some disorders where they're considering that, like women who have fetuses with congenital heart disease, for example. But we don't know what the long-term effects are of oxygen exposure, and it may shift the metabolism of the placenta. So it's not clear that oxygen would improve long-term function versus just change the metabolic state of the placenta at the detriment of the fetus. So we need to study that more to really make recommendations.
Here's a call from San Francisco from Alyssa in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi there. Hi. Go ahead. Oop. Well, I think it's a cell phone problem. Sounds like it. She was going to ask, could this study be used to predict small stature in twins?
In the small group that we studied, this preliminary study, we predicted the birth size, but that's not predictive of stature long term. So we haven't been able at this point in time to come up with these measures. Don't look like they're going to be able to predict height.
Dr. Bianchi, what other research is coming out of the Human Placenta Project?
Well, again, so the focus is non-invasive and in real time. So we're focusing on different aspects of imaging. We're also focusing on things that we can determine from blood samples in pregnant women. So we're looking at RNA, one of the nucleic acids. We're looking at lipids. We're looking at the microbiome. And we're trying to determine whether if you take a blood sample from a pregnant woman that we would get additional information about the biology or the health of the placenta.
And how long will your study go on, the project go on for?
Yeah, so the project started in 2015, and the first group of projects started with development of novel technologies, such as Dr. Grant's project. Most of the grants are now in their first cycle, so they're somewhere between 3 and 5 years. And then we will reevaluate what we've learned.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. It's an interesting new topic we've never discussed. Dr. Ellen Grant, Professor of Radiology and Pediatrics at Harvard Med School. Dr. Diana Bianchi, Director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH. Thank you for being with us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Yeah.
You too.
You're welcome.
You too.
When we come back, we're going to take a break first and then talk about new additions to the Atlas of Exoplanets. Pack your bags because there are a lot more new exoplanets that have come onto our radar. They were all discovered. We'll talk about the new Atlas of 4,000 potential distant worlds. 4,000. 10 that could be rocky planets. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, scientists from NASA's Kepler mission unveiled their latest set of planet-hunting results, including hundreds of new planet candidates and 10 that could be rocky planets within that Goldilocks, that habitable zone of their stars. And so far, the mission has identified over 4,000 potential distant worlds. Susan Thompson, Kepler research scientist at the SETI Institute and lead author of the new research, joins me from the campus of NASA Ames in Silicon Valley. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
So how many planets is this now?
We are up to just over about 4,000 planet candidates once you add this catalog in, though we've only confirmed about 2,030 or so of them.
Wow. Wow. And these 10 that could be rocky planets.
Yeah, with this catalog, we were able to extend out and find really long period planets that are in the habitable zone and really small planets that could be rocky. They're about the same size as the Earth using the Kepler spacecraft.
Let's refresh our memory for us, would you please, about how Kepler finds the planets that are so far away?
So Kepler is like a big bucket for light. We're just measuring how bright the stars are. And what we're looking for is the planet passing in front of the star. And that causes the star to just suddenly look a little bit dimmer for just an hour or two, or maybe up to 12 hours. And we see that happen several times. And once we see that happen several times, we call it a planet candidate. And that's what we were collecting in this catalog.
And so these 200 planets, are they all from the same part of the sky, or are they all spread out all over?
Yeah, this was all from Kepler's original mission, where we were looking at the part of the sky near Cygnus, the Swan.
So you have 4,000 candidates in total from this one area?
That's right, 4,000 candidates from just this one part of the sky.
So they've got to be, if this is 4,000 from a tiny little speck in the sky, there must be untold numbers of candidates out there.
Exactly. That means there are billions of planets out there. There are more planets out there than there are stars, which just completely blows my mind.
Blows
you go out there and look
too.
At the stars. Yeah. You look up at those stars and, you know, if only you could see the planets, you would see more planets than you do stars.
Wow. And the possibility of life on any of these exoplanets?
Oh, there's always possibilities. It's not what we were able to measure with the Kepler spacecraft, but that's what, you know, people are going to continue to work towards, is can we measure to see, can we find oxygen on these planets? Can we determine, find ones that are very similar to the Earth, that possibly, maybe, that somebody's living on them.
Mm-hmm. So all we can pretty much deduce is their size and their distance from their star so far.
We also can tell from that distance, we can tell about how warm they are, which is why we know they're in the habitable zone. Because when you add in the temperature of the star and how far away it is, then we can say, oh, is this planet warm? You know, some place you'd want to live? Or is it going to be freezing cold because it's too far away from the star?
Yeah, so you have all of these 4,000 candidates. How do you decide which ones are the better ones for being, living in the zone that might have life in them?
Well, we're picking the ones that are most similar to the Earth, because the Earth is the only place we know has life right now. And so that's how we picked it. So we picked those that show that they're about the same size as the Earth. So we believe there might be a surface that you could actually stand on. And we hope that these planets, therefore, can hold an atmosphere as well. But we don't know that. And then we're also picking those that are the right distance away from the star. So they're just the right temperature.
Now, if you need the planet to move between the star and the telescope to detect it, does that mean there are probably even more planets out there? They're just not in the right orientation for us to see them?
You're exactly right. So we only see about, for Sun-like stars, something like 1 in 200 of planets transit. So that means, for everyone that we see, there's 200 more out there that we didn't see.
I'm trying to digest.
So, yeah, we found 10, but that means there's 200 times 10, 2,000.
Wow. Okay.
That's simple math.
Does that blow your mind as much as it does mine when you think about it?
Absolutely. But, I've been thinking about this for a while now. This is what Kepler was designed to do. And so we've been hoping that we'd find these so that we can start to understand how many planets are actually out there that are similar to the Earth.
So you say that's what Kepler has been designed to do. Has its mission changed recently at all?
Yeah, Kepler, after it spent 4 years looking at that Cygnus field, went off and is now pointing at fields along the ecliptic. Now, it's still looking for exoplanets, but it's also doing a whole bunch of other types of astrophysics, from supernova down to asteroids. When I say the ecliptic, I guess I should clarify, that's the part of the sky that's has your zodiac symbols in it.
So those
are the constellations many of you probably know about. So it's looking at different fields, each field for about 80 days. And from that, we can still find short-period planets. And so they're continuing to find them. And they're looking for planets around some of the smaller stars now.
So would it be safe to say you're still sifting through all that data that you still have?
Well, the data from the original mission, we're basically done sifting through it. We've put all of our best minds and efforts at getting through that data. And this was our last search. But people will continue to use these results and the data and keep finding new gems in it. I don't think Kepler is done at all in that way.
How long is Kepler's lifetime, do we expect?
You'll have to really ask someone who knows well, but I just... I expect that we will make it through quarter 17, 18. It's a little unsure. It's about when Kepler runs out of fuel. So there's about another year that we're collecting data for using Kepler.
And the new Webb telescope, will that do anything that Kepler can't?
Oh, yeah. James Webb Space Telescope is, in terms of exoplanets, what people are hoping to use it for is to start to actually measure the atmospheres of some of these exoplanets. So it's not trying to find the exoplanets, but study them further. Can you figure out, is there oxygen, for instance, on the surface of one of these planets?
Because it will specialize in the infrared section, right?
Correct. That's what it's going to do.
So you'll use Kepler to get the candidates narrowed down, and then when the Webb telescope comes online, everybody's fingers crossed, that will then focus on seeing if there's a real atmosphere on any of those planets. Wow.
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
Wow. You're such a boring job, Dr. Thompson.
Not boring at all. I'm super excited.
I'm sure you are. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
Susan Thompson, Kepler Research Scientist at SETI Institute, and we'll check back in with her. You may recall from watching an animation in some science documentary, and there have been plenty of them, the elegant way in which the double helix DNA molecule duplicates itself. We always see it unzipping and then duplicating, coming back together. Well, those animations may need some reworking, because writing in the journal Cell, researchers report that they've captured the replication process for a single DNA molecule on video. They're claiming it might be the first time it's ever been done. The process they observed doesn't go quite as smoothly as those animations we see on TV do. Stephen Kowalczykowski is a professor at the University of California in Davis, and one of the researchers on his findings. He joins me by phone from France this evening. Thank you for taking time out of your vacation, Dr. Kowalczykowski, to be with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's not a vacation. I'm out here for a conference, but I'm pleased to do this because I'm a longtime fan of the show. So my pleasure.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. Thank you very much. How do you get a movie, making movie out of a DNA replication?
Well, with a lot of luck and a lot of work. So what we do is initially need to trap or capture a single DNA molecule. And what we do alternatively is either attach it to the surface of a glass slide, which we're going to use in the fluorescent microscope, or in some cases we attach it to a bead and capture that with an optical trap, an infrared laser. And then, of course, you can't see DNA by eye. So what we do is we stain it with a fluorescent dye. That allows us to image it. And then the other thing you need to know is DNA normally is a coiled molecule. So to see everything that's going on DNA, we need to extend it. And we typically do that by solution flow. So flow will extend DNA the way flow extends things that are attached in the water, like seaweed. We can also use a second optical trap, but we didn't use that in this particular study. And then basically we need to introduce the proteins, and we do that a number of different ways. So having done all that, then there's a sort of a start button, and we start reactions different ways. In this particular case, we started them by adding all of the nucleoside triphosphates. And then if all goes well, you can watch this in real time.
Wow. And in the video you shared with us, which is on our website at sciencefriday.com/DNA, looks like tiny white streaks moving along a black field. What are we seeing there? Those streaks that you talked about, the fluorescent?
That's correct. So at the very start, zero time, what you see are just bright white spots on a black background. And each one of those spots is a DNA molecule, the template molecule. It's a 8.6 kilobase pair DNA molecule, which is visualized by virtue of this fluorescent dye that's bound to it. And then as when the video starts, what you see is some good fraction of those template molecules elongate, and they're moving towards the right. And the reason they're moving towards the right is because the flow is coming from the left. So, and at each one of those molecules, if you look carefully, you can notice at the right side, it's just a little bit brighter, and that's because there's more DNA there. That's the template DNA. It's circular. And so what you're watching is a replication of a DNA molecule in real time.
And your paper, what you write about, says that what surprised you is that the replication is not like we see in the movies or the descriptions in the textbooks.
Right. So basically, there are many ways of thinking about what you should see. The classic picture is that you have a leading strand polymerase that moves at a constant rate, and then the second polymerase, the one that copies the strand in the opposite direction, has to move discontinuously. So it should move in shorter pieces. And what we expected was to see a continuous movement on the leading strand, and we didn't see that. What we instead saw that the leading strand polymerase would stop sometimes, and in fact it would change speed sometimes, and then it would do this in a random way. So it showed stochastic variations in speed punctuated by these pauses. And that was unexpected. What we could then see subsequently is that the DNA helicase that you mentioned in the introduction would oftentimes proceed independently of the polymerase.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So if I could paraphrase of what you said, and tell me if I get this right, you have it's two halves of the DNA ladder, the double helix. They're sort of zipping down, and then they're going to be, each side is going to get reproduced to bring the other half that it needs back. But I, as it was described to me, it's sort of like a traffic on a clogged highway, on a freeway. You have two cars next to one another, and instead of them both coming together smoothly, one starts, one stops, and you'll see the car next to you, but you all wind up together.
Right. So you're describing an analogy I gave in terms of the publication, and what that analogy refers to is the coordination of the two polymerases, the leading strand and the lagging strand. One of the other things we expected to see was that there'd be some way that the polymerase that has to go through more steps would tell the one that doesn't go through all the steps that it needs to control this, be communicate with it with regards to how far it's gotten in synthesizing its strand. And we didn't see any evidence of this coordination.
No.
But rather what we saw is the stochastic variation. And the analogy on the highway, the freeway, was that oftentimes when you're driving down the freeway, traffic and drivers are driving seemingly at random speeds. And oftentimes you think you're gaining on this person next to you, but then oftentimes you're delayed or slowed and the other person has the opportunity to speed up. And if this is done completely stochastically, at the end, neither of you gain on the other, yet you wind up at the same place. And this analogy applies to the way replication works, which is that they don't coordinate with one another, but rather change speeds and pause stochastically.
Well, what this says in your paper is that because they're not zipping together at the same speed, that unzipped, they may remain vulnerable to damage for a longer period of time than suspected?
Well, in some ways, that is a potential problem. So what happens is, let's say, in terms of coordination of leading and lagging strand synthesis, the so-called fragments, these partial fragments, Okazaki fragments, can be different sizes, but the gaps are made up because at some opportunity the lagging strand polymerase can go faster. But the other problem is that if a polymerase stops, the helicase that unwinds DNA ahead of it creates single strand DNA, which, mm-hmm. as you pointed out, can be a problem. But the helicase just doesn't continue unabated. In fact, it continues, but it slows only one-fifth of its speed. And this we refer to as a dead man switch, so that there's a built-in control mechanism.
Doctor, we've run out of time, Dr. Kawasikowski. I have to say goodbye, but we'll pick this up later. Stephen Kawasikowski is the Simmons Professor of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at UC Davis. One last thing before I go. I hope you've been listening to and enjoying our new podcast, Undiscovered. This week on the show, it's the 1940s. A team of scientists at General Electric team up with the military on a series of radical experiments in weather control.
This is something that the military saw one way and the scientists saw another way. The scientists thought, how great if we could steer hurricanes so that they don't hit the shore. And, you know, if we could steer hurricanes away from big cities, that would be wonderful. The military was thinking, wow, we could really mess with Cuba.
But one of GE's staff, a young press writer by the name of Kurt Vonnegut, was watching closely, and soon the company's science would inspire some of his most iconic stories. If you're a Vonnegut fan, you can't miss this one. Check out Undiscovered on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you'd like to listen, or visit undiscoveredpodcast.org. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.